Lecture 8, The Story of Jesus. Did Jesus travel and study in the rabbinical schools? It's a good question. Were there rabbinical schools? There really were no rabbinical schools. We hear about schools of various natures which followed later, but at that time, no. George Lanza, in creating from the Aramaic the Bible that he has, and in this work that he has here, The Gospel Light, he says here, I believe Jesus could have walked on water if there was a need. He could have used his divine power. The question is not could he, but did he? Jesus refused the Jews when they demanded a sign, a magic. He did not pose as a magician. I do believe in the divinity of Jesus. I do not question the power of Jesus, who has revealed God to humanity in such an abundant way. I believe Jesus opened the eyes of the blind, cleansed the lepers, raised the dead, and that he himself rose again. I insist that Jesus never worked any magic or wonders in order to persuade the people. I firmly believe in his divine mission and in his miraculous powers, which are still being demonstrated in the lives of faithful followers today. Millions of souls have been healed by him. Untold numbers of broken hearts have been comforted by his words of life. Men and women have surrendered to him in all of the centuries. Herein is found the greatest miracle of his mission, which has not lost its power even at the present day. This fact and the successful continuance of the church are of the most convincing proof of the living Christ who abideth forever. Interesting way of stating it. What were the early schools that we hear about, the rabbinical schools? Well, think about it. Here we have University of Healing. We're a school. You go into the telephone book and you look up schools and you find them by the thousands. You look up bona fide universities and you find them by the hundreds all over the United States, all over the world. And you look at us. In the beginning, we were not authorized and we were not bona fide by the state. By the state we were, but recently the Better Business Bureau said to us, you have to be approved by the state to be a member of the Better Business Bureau. You have to be approved as a secondary school of the state. And so we said, well, how do you do that? And they said, well, here's a form. So we took the form and filled it out, and we qualified hands down. We qualified 100% to be approved by the state as a school of approved in the secondary series of schools. And that's quite a compliment. That's quite a compliment to our teachings, to our philosophy, and to the manner in which the school is being presented. Because all schools are not given that authorization. And in fact, our school is one of the few schools of this nature which have been permitted to use the word EDU, education, on the end of our email. We are www.university-of-healing.edu, which means education. And so we're one of the few schools in the country who are working as we are working, who have been approved for that and also for the secondary division of the state of California. Now, there are a lot of schools here, and there are a lot of schools elsewhere, and there are a lot of what may be called rabbinical schools. But the rabbinical schools really did not develop until quite distant, because every rabbi was a teacher. and every rabbi had the ability to perform, to prepare students to be rabbis. Every ordained rabbi in the Hebrew teaching was ordained, was authorized to ordain other rabbis, other students to become rabbis in the teaching. And this is not true for us. We have students all over the world who have graduated from the University of Healing, Church of God Unlimited, and they're not authorized to establish or to ordain students. We have to do that. Because if they're going to be ordained in the teaching of God Unlimited, we have to know for sure that this is the teaching that they teach. And if they're going to represent us, we have to show that through their records of their training at the University of Healing, they have been trained in such a way. Now, in Jesus' time, they had communities of 50 people, 100 people, maybe 1,000 people. They didn't have large groups. Now you say, well, what about the 5,000 he had on the hillside? Sure, he had 5,000 people on the hillside. Where'd they come from? They came from all the little communities around. All the little communities around. And as, hey, you know, we look at yesterday in today's eyes, and we are looking amiss by doing that. Look at 1900. 1900. Did they have television? Nope. Was radio prominent everywhere? Nope. Some places, maybe. Did they have movie picture theaters everywhere? Nope. What were the Chautauquas? You ever heard of the Chautauquas? The Chautauquas were lectures given by a group of people who spoke on various aspects of philosophy and religion and science, and they would meet together in the great out-of-doors, so to speak, in great a tent city, and the people would come from all over who were intellectual people, who wanted to take advanced courses, you might say, in the teachings of these various teachers. And they were some of the most outstanding teachers of the century who taught at the Chautauquas. And wouldn't that have been wonderful to have taped them or have even had lectures, copies of their lectures, of the interesting things that they wrote about, but talked about. Well, you see, education is quite different. Now let's go back to 1850. Now that's no big deal, is it? And 1950, 1850, just 100 years. Or let's go back to 1750, 1650. And as we go back, the a number of the population becomes minuscule compared to the 6 billion people on Earth today. And not more than 10 years ago, it was how many billion? It was like 4 billion. And say the 19th century, what was the population? I don't have the figure at my fingertips, but I would imagine it to be in the millions. In the millions. Not billions, but millions. And look at the beginning of the 17th century. There are hundred thousands, you know. And look at the beginning of the 16th century, 14th century, and on back. We get smaller and smaller and smaller because there's less people. And the people do gather together in cities, mainly, for their large numbers. But then again, that isn't all of them. Now, naturally, when you have a city of 300 people, in fact, I liked newspapers in small communities, and I had about three or four of them. And one was in Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin. It had 5,000 people, a full-fledged city, a beautiful city. We had a mayor and the council and everything else, and we had streets. I think we had two main streets. One main street was the one my newspaper office was on, and it was a block up the street, and then it became residential. It was only for one block that it was commercial. And then The commercial street itself was maybe about 8 blocks long, 10 blocks at the most, but 8 to 10 blocks. And that's with all the stores, that's with all the drugstore and the butcher shop and the shoemaker and everything else under the sun. And we had our newspaper there. And our newspaper was supported from the advertising of these various stores, plus the stores in outlying communities. And we were a big community right on the Mississippi River, where the Mississippi and Wisconsin River join. And I was editor there for 2 years. And they had a radio station there, and the radio station couldn't afford half the things they wanted to do. It was a good radio station. And they asked me if I would come over and give a news report once a day at noon on what's going on in the community. Here I was, a young punk kid who just graduated. My son was like maybe 2 years old, and it was wonderful. It was a great experience. I learned a lot. But you see, I knew everybody. I knew everybody in that town of 5,000 people. Yeah, that's right. You knew everybody. You knew their ups and downs and ins and outs. And I even learned sign language, because a couple of the youngsters in town were deaf and dumb, and they could not speak anyway except with sign language. And so I had to learn sign language with them. And I spoke in the local church and did all these things. What I'm trying to say is, this is a small community. And that's a big community, 5,000 people, compared to the community in which Jesus lived. The community of Bible times, that was maybe hundreds of people, if that many people, you know? And you knew everybody in town, and you knew everything that was going on in town. And Jesus had his teaching, had his ministry, as a very human ministry, speaking to the people on their human failings and on their human callings and on their human aspects. And so Jesus had to be alert and aware of these things. Or did he?
No.
Or did he?
No.
When, if you listen to the illustrations that he gave, the parables that he gave, you find that they show very little sensitivity to what life really was like, and show a sensitivity to the ideal life. You follow that? And so his ministry was to the ideal life. He said, "Let the little children come unto me, for such is the kingdom of heaven." Do you think he had any kids of his own? No. Do you think that he had any kids in his own family? No. At the time that he was aware of any kids in his family, he could give less concern. And do you think he was a babysitter for the neighbor's kids? Nope, they didn't have that in those days. You see, he didn't know anything about kids. And yet, he knew that in the innocence of a child, "Let the little children come unto me, for such is the kingdom of heaven." He knew about the innocence of the little child. And they're really innocent. They didn't have television. They didn't have sex shows. They didn't have talk of older boys and girls doing things and saying things. Sex was very common in their home, because they all lived in the same room. They slept in the same room. And mother and daddy created children in the same room with the children living there. You know? And it was a natural, normal thing. Just like going in the barn and having the cows copulating and creating calves and things like that. It's a normal thing for a farm child to be aware of. And so it had no right, wrong, up, down, in or out. And of course, as soon as a child was ready to be, to have a child, as soon as a child was mature enough to get married, they got married. They got them out. The children didn't live at home. There were 18-year-old children living at home, 20-year-old, 40-year-old children living at home. When they were 12, 10, 12, 15, they were out of that house. They were out. Now, there were many big farms like Abraham's farm and Noah's farm and the other great prophets or people of Bible time, and they kept their family, but they were married. The son And the daughter got out and got married, and they had their house here, and they had their house here. Part of the farm is part of the community. And perhaps the father populated his own community. He created a couple dozen sons with a couple dozen wives, and then somebody else had other children, and they brought them back, and they married, and they had these wonderful communities filled with their own children. And that's why the idea, the concept of father is so understandable and so usable in Bible times. Now, this is where we fall short in listening to the stories of Jesus, because we think of it in the 21st century type of a life, which it was not. And he did not have the television. He did not have the telephone. He did not have the universities. He did not have the educational organizations. Now, what was the greatest university? The Alexandrian University. Remember that one? You don't remember it, but it burned down. But it was at the Alexandrian Library. But the Alexandrian University was a fabulous university. But it was in a totally different area. It was in a secular area and not a religious area. And the moment it got religious, what happened? Then it burned down. Then it was destroyed. And the reason for that was that people did not want to either follow the many gods of the Romans and follow the many gods even of the Greeks and what have you. They wanted to have the one God, which was the God of the Hebrews and the tribes of people who lived in the desert there. And you see, the reason great schools did not take place until the Muslims started to develop them was that they had to have a continuity. And the continuity was a continuity of information. And the continuity of information was brought about by the Muslim teaching, which was everywhere. It was in every country, and it was in every land. And they didn't judge the teaching. They just, except they, where it concerned the Muslim teaching, that was sacrosanct. But anything else went. And so they brought this forth and brought this out into the land. And there were so many places in Spain and in France and in Italy and in Greece and Turkey and so forth, where the Muslim teachings were so beautiful and their temples of learning were so exquisite that they were called, you know, by modern day standards, the ultimate of the teaching machine. Now, Jesus had none of that. He had none of that. He had no large organization, even you might say the Hebrew organization. Do you really know that the Jews were one of the smallest segments of the church group, you might say, of the church group down there in that area? One of the smallest ones? And today, they are one of the smallest ones. You look them up in the almanac, and you'll find the Hebrews and the Jews to be very small-numbered compared to many another. And even the Christians are not as big as some of the Buddhists Islam is under there too. But it's a fascinating thing when you look at it just in today. Now, if today is any indication of what it might have been then just imagine how few people followed that teaching. And yet, it became the foundation teaching of all the Christian religion in the world, which is quite remarkable. Now, when we can understand that, then we can realize why it was so important for Jesus to just play it cool. Why he did not want to be the ruler of the world. He knew if he allowed himself to be called the ruler of the world, you know, the king of the Israelites, if he were called that, he's up to be killed, you know. Because once the throne is established, then there are a lot of people who want to be on that throne. And Jesus had no interest in being on that throne in the first place. But back to our point here for our story. Did Jesus travel and study in the rabbinical schools? What did Jesus teach? He taught an intuitive philosophy. What did Jesus teach? He taught an intuitive philosophy. We go through some of the statements here. The poor in pride, the mourners, the non-resistance, the cloak and coat, and obeying orders, that's a good one, and new cloth and old garments, and fasting and wedding feasts, and the congregation and little children, and being worthy, and the son of David, and seducers, and holding his feet, and a staff, Sodom and Gomorrah, and Harem and Antipas, victims scourged before the execution, women at the sepulchre, and salutations on the road, and labor shortage. I mean, my goodness sakes, all these things are purely intuitive attitudes of being a human from a spiritual point of view. And this is something that we all want to be very, very much aware of. What do we teach here? Let's just... Play this game for a second with you. Ellen, not going by anything that we've talked about recently, and not going by our standard philosophical point of view, but what do we teach here? What do we tell other people that we're teaching? What do we tell other organizations and schools and stuff? What do we teach?
Healing, because when they're teaching, just a minute.
Dodi, what do you think we're teaching?
I want to live a happy life.
You're closer. Now, what are we teaching?
We are teaching the divinity of all men.
What are we teaching?
Be myself and have fun.
Exactly. Be myself and have fun.
What are we teaching?
We are divine.
What do we go around telling people that we're teaching? We're teaching positive thinking. Yes, oh, for heaven's sakes, that's right. That's what we're teaching. We're teaching positive thinking. Now, is positive thinking a religion?
No.
Positive thinking is having a positive attitude toward your life and its affairs and its activities, and having a positive attitude toward all things that are good and beautiful. Now, it's true, we teach that you're God. But that's only because that's what you are. And we teach a lot of other things, and it's only because that's what it is. And it's not a matter that we're teaching it to teach you. That just sort of goes with the package. Now, Lydia,
yes.
If you are teaching positive thinking, what is the most important thing for you to get across to your student? That's one of the things, and a very good one. Teaching positive thinking, we cannot afford to be judgmental. Now, what's another thing? What we cannot, and of course you can go through the list of four, but what else do we do about being positive thinking?
Let go of the past.
What?
Let go of the past.
We live in the present. You said that very well. We live in the present. Dodi?
Thank you
for listening. We live in the present.
Yes.
We live in the present. Right?
Right.
Right, yeah. You see, we want to keep it as away from the negative. Let go of the past. We live in the present. And, of course, her being non-judgmental, mm-hmm. It could be presumed to be negative. What could be, we really haven't worked on this, but what could be a good word for non-judgmental in a positive way? What could it be?
To be affirmative.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good, but it's negative again. What would be another word for non-judgmental in a positive way?
Hmm.
Yeah, that's a lot of words.
Speak the truth.
Let's see if we can find one word.
See the good.
Huh?
One
good.
Word. See the good.
See the good. When you are non-judgmental, you are accepting, or you are, that's the word that we've been looking for years. What would you be if you were not judgmental?
You would be unconditional.
You what?
I am neutral.
Neutral.
Neutral. Well, no, because that means you would allow for the negative to be said as well as the positive. And if we are teaching positive thinking, we want to keep it toward the positive. Now, neutral is as close a word as we have come to it so far. Because to be neutral means you are non-judgmental, positive, or... Now, just a minute. Maybe that's a very good word.
Yes.
Maybe neutral is a very good word, because non-judgmental means you don't judge it positive or negative.
Exactly.
You are neutral. Now, neutral sounds kind of weak, but really it's quite strong.
Well, we could look up some synonyms.
No. Yes, that's true. Well, did you write that down?
I did.
Well, that's good. Let's write that down, because that's good stuff. Now, this is what Jesus did by himself. He brain-trusted himself, brain-teased. He looked within for different ways of saying things to get away. What is one of the primary things that the Jews do among themselves? They get angry with each other. And they hate each other. And I know that sounds terrible, and that's judgmental perhaps, but the thing is, that's why they find it so difficult to be non-judgmental. They find it so difficult to be not possessed. That's mine, you know. And that's what we all fall into, that trap. Now, we want to, this neutral thing, it's sort of like an empty box, but it perhaps is the answer, because it's no judgment one way or another. Now, untouched, what would you do with that word? Touched.
But that also includes the negative nature.
That's what I said. What would you do with that word to make it positive?
Oh, okay.
You know.
Unconditional loving.
Unconditional loving, that's the package. That's the good package that comes out of those words. But unconditional loving, if we keep the idea of unconditional loving before us on all of these concepts, then we are doing what Jesus did. Now, what did Jesus say on his two commandments? What were they?
Love
the Lord thy God with all the soul and all the might, and love your neighbor like yourself. Okay, now, what was he teaching? He was teaching positive thinking at the very peak of positive thinking, the highest level. Now remember that. We sometimes, it's because so many people say they're teaching positive thinking, you know. So think positive about being wealthy. Think positive about being healthy. Think positive about all these different things. Well, that's great, except what happens? What happens is that you become so enamored with the healthy, wealthy stuff like that, that you sometimes forget about the universal aspect of it. You are independently wealthy. Now, tell me I'm wrong. You won't. No, you see, you're independently wealthy. You are not wealthy because of something. You see, that's the big thing. You're not wealthy because your daddy left you a lot of money, or you won the sweepstakes, or you had a good job, or whatever, or you invested wisely. You are independently wealthy because you are independently wealthy. And there's no other reason. There's no other reason. Now, why did Solomon become king? Why did David become king? Why did Kennedy become king? Why did the various presidents become presidents in the United States and around the world? Why did the people in politics become the people? It's not because they were good. It's not because they were capable. It's not because they had a lot of money. It's that they believed it in themselves. Now, Harry Truman, he was a poor guy. And he went right up to the top. He believed in himself. He was a good man. He had a lot of principles. And he went right to the top. And then at the very top, when the election was like point and point with Dewey and Truman, and the newspaper said, Dewey wins because Dewey is the smart guy. And Truman loses, even though he's vice president and he's now out of office, but he loses. Well, Truman won by a lot because the newspapers misinterpreted what the facts were, you see? Misjudged what the final tally of the voting would be. Now, why did Truman win? And I'm not trying to be a politician here, but why did Truman... Yes, he won for what?
One-pointed.
Yeah, he was a Gomer Pyle. He was a Forrest Gump, you know. He was so one-pointed, he wasn't concerned whether he got it or didn't get it. He just was concerned in being one-pointed on thinking about whatever he thought about. I will get my fish boat, you know. I will do whatever. And he felt he was unworthy of the girl, and that's why he didn't get her. And yet, if we were to make a comparison, who was the better person, the girl or he? You know? The girl was just doing her thing, having fun, but she wasn't doing her thing. She was living a life of anger, a life of retribution against the world, of anger against her father, of anger against her community, of anger against everything that happened to her, even though she was a pretty nice girl, you know. But when you live in anger, you lose everything, and she did. And he lost everything too, you know. But did he? He didn't claim them. He loved them when he had them, and he released them when he didn't. That's a magic situation. Think about these things for yourself, and think about how these things work in your world. And when you start thinking about the life of Jesus and the story of Jesus, hey, he was blessed living in a time of scarcity. There were not televisions and radios and cars and discos and what have you to distract his attention. He didn't have any of those things. All he had was listening to the divine within him. Now, why is it that the people were not educated in his time? Why is it that the people did not read and did not write? Why is it? Because the educators taught them not to read and not to write. Because the educators wanted to be the ones who taught them. You understand? Now, the Catholic Church was this way too. Not on purpose necessarily, but the monks and the priests knew how to read, they knew how to write, and the people didn't. And so, what did the church do, which was the anathema of all anathemas, which was, if you can say, the evil of all evils? The church came out and spoke to the people and told them the stories of the Bible in
Latin.
And the people didn't even understand English or German or French or whatever the language was. And here they had the Bible in Latin. And they didn't understand that. So they had no idea what Jesus really said. They had no idea what the Bible had really said. The church did not want the people to know Because if the people knew, then the people would realize they didn't need the church. They could do, it is done unto you according to your belief, Jesus taught. He said, become as a little child in your innocence, and all things will be, knock, and God will open the door and give you whatever you ask. Now you see, perhaps the priest told the people these things. Let's give them the possibility. Perhaps the priesthood spoke in their sermons to the people and explained it to them. But why did they put the Word of God, the Word of God, the Holy Word of God, in a language that people couldn't understand? Kind of a shame, isn't it?
So they were
possessed.
People had to go through them.
They had to go through the priest to get to God. And they didn't go to Jesus. I mean, they should have had a bunch of statues of Jesus at each of the confessional boxes. And you go and confess it, Jesus, I goofed. And then Jesus would cry, or he'd smile, and he'd say, that's okay, just don't do it anymore. Go and sin no more. What did Jesus say to the terrible sins that were done in his presence, in his awareness? Go and sin no more. No. Should the priests do something different? Should the rabbis do something different? Have you ever read many Sufi stories? The Sufi stories are so charming. And in the Sufi stories, if this truly is what the Muslims teach, and is truly what the Muslim philosophy, is, I've read the Muslim teaching, so I know what they teach. But the thing is, it's the same as the Christian teaching, basically. But if the Sufis and their stories, so charmingly told, at the same time the early church was there, remember? At the same time as the early church. And they told stories like that, people would have really been uplifted, you know? People would have really felt fantastic. Now, Jesus didn't go to any of these schools because there were no schools. There was only an occasional... And who did the prophet speak to? The people or to the kings? And to the priests? Who did the great wise one speak to?
The ruler.
The ruler. And who was the one who was talking to the king most? The priests were whispering in their ear. The priests were the ministers. In fact, the priests were running the country. The priests took over running many countries. And this is neither good nor bad. All it is saying, how can you be an adequate priest to the people if you are going to be their ruler and tell them what, how many pair of underwear they're supposed to wear, you know? You know, kind of silly, isn't it? But this is what it is. They wanted me to be the mayor of Prairie du Chien. Rather Atwater, and Prairie du Chien too, but I didn't want to run. I was really too young then, I thought. But in Atwater, they wanted me to run for the mayor's job, because the mayor and I were buddies, and he says, Herb, you write our stories, you do our things, you're so, you know, into us, you you know what we're thinking, and you help us in the newspaper, by instead of saying the SOBs and stuff like that, you say the men who were not giving their attention to the job as they could have, you know, using very beautiful, acceptable words. They wanted me to do it, and I said, no. If I become the mayor, I have to have the city as my first responsibility, not the newspaper. And the newspaper is the people. The people who read the newspaper expect to get the correct version of what's going on by their legislators. And if I am a legislator, I am going to color that newspaper very much and have it say what I think the legislators want to have the people understand. And, of course, the people would love the legislators if I was mayor and editor of the paper, but that's not the point. That's not the point. We don't want people to love the priests. We don't want people to love the ministers and the practitioners. We don't want people to love Jesus. We want people to love what Jesus taught. and what these others are supposed to be teaching. Because if we don't do that, what are we doing? What are we doing? If we don't do that, what we are doing is we are just worshiping a stone, okay? Jesus, Jesus, you know, kiss the book. Kiss the book, Jesus. The word of Jesus. Now, kiss the Bible. Show that you show allegiance to him. Do you know what's in there? No. have you ever read any of this stuff? The printing looks nice, you know. How many people know what's in the Bible? Well, you say, well, look at all the Bibles, the best-selling book in the world, and in every home is a Bible, basically. Gertrude? In your lifetime, how many times have you picked up the Bible to read, not to dust, to read in your home? And your answer has to be very seldom. No. And I say to Ellen and Sylvia and Ingeborg, I mean, these are people here, you know, and I say to them, now, what did Jesus say about that? I don't know. Well, didn't you read the Bible? No. You are a minister. You are ordained. You conduct weddings. You conduct funerals. You are doing all, and you don't know what Jesus said? Well, I don't teach that. What do you teach? I teach positive thinking. Okay, so you teach positive thinking. Then we should say, you know, people say, are you a Christian church to us? And I say, no, we're not a Christian church. I don't believe in what the Christians are teaching. The Christians are teaching alienation from one another. I am teaching togetherness. I am teaching oneness. I am teaching the teachings of Jesus the Christ as I read them in a plain old ordinary Bible, whether it's St. James or whether it's the New Condition, whatever Bible it may be. I just teach that straight across. And, you know, he said it straight across. Now, Mr. Lamza here, he's saying that people should not take the teachings literally, that Jesus did not take the teachings literally. Well, I say perhaps you should take them allegorically and parenthetically. Perhaps you should take them that way, but really, if they don't make sense literally, then they should be discarded. If the Bible doesn't make sense literally to you, if a man asks you for your cloak and you give it to him and then you give him your coat also, well, what is this? What is this? Well, Jesus was teaching, do not be possessed by your possessions. But that coat costs a lot of money. So what? So what? Just think how unburdened you're going to be with two less coats. Just think. Now, you see, he was teaching a very human and a very philosophical and psychological teaching, sound in every respect. And when he talked about the, it's easier for a camel to go through a needle's eye than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. Remember that story? Well, now, what did that mean? Well, here in Gospel Light, it says that the main gate, and you'll understand this, Edith, the main gate to any community is where the merchants must come in and pay their taxes before they can go in and sell. However, there are some merchants who want to come in the side gates, the gates that the people of the town use to go out to till their crops and things like that. And so they have made the side gates look like this. You know. And so if you try to take a camel through the side gate, it brushes everything off the camel's back. And that's called the needle's eye, the side gate. And so you're supposed to take your merchandise through the front gate and pay your taxes. Now, it's harder for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven than it is for a camel to enter through a needle's eye. So the camel, if he takes off his riches, his pack, he can go through there, okay? But if he's going to take all of his riches, all of his pack, and try to go through the needle's eye, he won't make it. And for a rich man to be possessed by his possessions and to want to enter into the kingdom of heaven, he'll have trouble. Because just in this pure, stupid, illogical, logical statement, have you ever met anyone in your entire life who took it with them?
No.
When they died, they took their wealth with them. Have you ever? As Jesus said, it is more difficult for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven than a camel to go through a needle's eye. The camel at least can brush it off or take it off. But the rich man, he is possessed by that money. And Jesus said, if you are to follow me, again a parable, take all that you have and give it to the poor and then follow me. But Jesus, I want my money while I'm with you. I want to be able to spend that, and I want my nice clothes, and I want this. Hey, if you want to follow me, do that. People come to campus here, and over the years this has been so true, and they would have money, and they would have pockets full of money, like Heinz Ortley, you know. And Heinz Ortley is the big, you know, much more, you know. And he owns the Ortley oil systems in Switzerland and stuff like that, you know, for the furnaces. And is very wealthy. But nice guy. But he's like everybody who's wealthy. And I said, Heinz, give me all your money. I'm going to put it in a box here for you. And when you're ready to leave here, take it with you. But while you're on campus, you don't spend any money. So Heinz gave me a lot. And then he would say to Stefan, come on, Stefan, let's go in town. We got to get this. So they go in town. And then they would go to the fanciest restaurant in town and eat, which is fine, you know. And Stefan thought that was pretty nice. And Stefan didn't have any money. But he always had people who had money with him. And so then we would all go in town and we would do some shopping. And, you know, because it's nice for everybody to go to town. And Heinz says, I'm taking us for lunch. I said, Heinz, you're not supposed to do that, you know. And Ellen came to campus. And she had all her jewels and all her wealth and all that stuff. She says, Herb, this is for the campus. I said, now, just a minute. We put it in a box here. Now, after a while, if you still feel the same way, okay. But we're just going to put that in a box now. And you see this little table? It had a drawer in my trailer. It was just a coffee table. And I stuck it in that drawer. In our trailer, which wasn't even locked, you know. And for years, you know, the different people's monies and wealth was right in there, and lots of it. I mean, not just hundreds of dollars, but thousands of dollars, and jewels and stuff. And it just was there. I had absolutely no interest in it. And everybody says, Herb, you're only into this for the money. Well, if I'm into this for the money, I would be doing a little more shouting. Because I could play a good Billy Graham, I'm sure. But you see, this is where we are. We are doing beautiful things. We are being fantastic people. We are being glorious expressions. And Jesus did too. Jesus said, when you go on your mission to other towns, take only your sandals and one suit of clothes and the staff. Every Hebrew wore all in his closet on his body at one time. That was his suitcase. And he carried it all with him. So when Jesus said, don't. Just take one pair of sandals and one robe and so forth, and there you are. And if the people in the town don't take you, don't like you, kick the dust of the town off your feet and go to the next town. Just do not be possessed. Do not be possessed. And you see, we read into that all sorts of wealth. The Catholic Church has become the wealthiest organization in the world. And how interesting. The very thing that Jesus told us not to do, they have done in abundance. Now, there's nothing wrong with being wealthy. There's nothing wrong with having money to do your things with. But I would suggest If I gave to a charity, you know what a charity is? I gave to a charity, and that charity had 90% of the money going to administration. You know what that means? 90% to administration, to running the charity, and 10% went to the charity people, you know, to give to the people. I would not be too happy about it, you know. And this is why a lot of corporations who pay such high prices to their chief executives are thought to be poorly run organizations. But there again, that's a little different situation. These chief executives, because of their great decisions and their great actions, can take a company of $10 million and in 1 year make it $100 million. And you don't think that executive is worth something? You bet your life, at least $10 million. You know what I mean? And so when companies do this, that's a financial, economic situation, pure and simple unto itself. It has nothing to do with philosophy or religion. Or does it? Or does it? Now, I want to step a little further here. When Jesus was doing his ministry, what did he wear? He wore a seamless robe. And there was only one of maybe a dozen seamless robes in all of Jerusalem. Only one. You know why? Because it was so expensive and so perfect and so beautiful and so wonderful. And there was the one.
Well, where did it come from?
That's another story. We'll talk about it if you wish. But he wore the most expensive suit of clothing in town. Do you understand?
Yeah.
Ellen, you get smart quick, don't you? But he wore the most expensive suit in town. And who gave it to him? The tax collector? Hardly. Yeah. The Pharaoh, the Egypt, Herod and, you know, and Caesar and that sort of stuff, the king, you know, and who gave it to him? We'll talk about that after lunch. But it's kind of interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Kind of interesting. We are having some very fascinating concepts coming to us here, and we're getting some insights into what Jesus really did. And it's not a bad thing at all. But Jesus did not teach a religion. He did not teach to worship God. He did not teach to worship himself. He did not teach to worship a country or anything else. He said, "Be ye therefore perfect, even as is your Father within you." We're supposed to just be perfect. That's all. Just be perfect. Just be happy. Just be magnificent. Just be great. It's a good start. So, until lunch is over, we will bring this to a halt. We'll have discussion if you like. And I want to bring up one little thing, and we'll just leave this run while I do it. I'm going to give you each a copy of this here. And this is my daily affirmations. You may have seen them. There are four sets of them here. And affirmations go like this. And they're not all perfect. They're good. Wherever I am, wherever I go, I am the peacemaker. The divine in me leaps forth in every thought I think, in every word I speak, and in every action I make. I am good, and my goodness harmonizes with the goodness I create in all of the world about me. I open my eyes to the beauty and love of God. I am the pure white light of loving kindness. I am honoring my purity as I live it. My body is eternally perfect, young, light, sinewy, well formed, handsome, perfect, eyes, ears, and voice. I live one as my divine self at all times. I love me. To the pure, all is pure. I love everyone in the world. I am absolute. I am the allness. In me is every expression. And then to the right here. Each atom in my physical being bursts forth with every choice I dream about. I create all things and release each creation to go forth to express the unique qualities, its unique qualities. I am the source of my wealth, therefore I am independently wealthy. My conscious choice creates all my awareness of being a master, of being divine, of being my absolute self. I live in my world and am untouched by the games being played around me. As a master consciousness, I am self-assured, self-aware, self-confident, living in a constant state of peace of mind. I choose to create my world as affluent, comfortable, healthy, independent, and fully aware of who I am. Neat stuff, huh?
Yeah.
I am an island alone in the sea of God, in the allness, yet out of this allness is my uniqueness and my exciting possibility. I listen with my ears to the harmony of God in all. I am sensitive to my universe of good. As I arise in the morning, as I sit to my breakfast, as I begin any task, as I eat any meal, as I greet my family, my friends, and my associates, I do so with a smile in my heart and anticipation of the goodness in the day ahead. All in the world, all the world loves a lover. This is me. I am the greatest lover in the world, trained on loving myself first. With my fabulous love, I love all others and all circumstances in my existence. God bursts out of me in every expression of my physical being so powerfully that there is no otherness, there is no difference between the divine me and the physical person I call myself. I acknowledge peace and love. And the last of the four, I am pure in my thought for my choice in life. I create my own affirmations, reflecting what is in my heart and what I desire to outpicture in my life and to mirror all about in my world, all about in my world. This is all my choice. Daily, I powerfully speak affirmations and get the most out of life. My eyes are the mirror of my soul, not the cleanness of my eyes, not the human perfection of wisdom. The goodness shines out, hence everyone sees the real spiritual me so brilliantly that that is all that exists. I give all that I am and all that I have to my world, and still I have infinite goodness to share from the never-ending source, God within me. God is love. God so loved the world that all that has existence in the world is love. It is my privilege to recognize love everywhere. So you can take these affirmations and use them however you wish, and just send them out to friends as though they were yours, and they are, and just use them and have fun. And we have tons more if they interest you. So there too. Oh, now we may finish. So have a nice lunch, and I love you. I love you. I love you.